Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for November 2016. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Bruskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. We've all seen the statues of Lady Justice with her blindfold and scales. In an ideal world, Justice would be blind and simply weighing the evidence to resolve the dispute. But, unfortunately, justice is dispensed by humans, and humans have biases. Christopher Robertson is a professor of law at the University of Arizona and is its associate dean for research and innovation. He's currently teaching at NYU Law and on sabbatical. A book he has recently co-edited is entitled Blinding as a Solution to Bias, Strengthening Biomedical Science, Forensic Science, and Law. It was published in 2016. Earlier this month, Professor Robertson attended at the University of Toronto Faculty of Law to give a presentation at the annual Patent Colloquium. The title of his presentation was Bias in Litigation Science, and he provided a very interesting perspective on an area that our courts are now beginning to explore in the area of intellectual property law, blinded experts. I spoke with Chris from his office in New York City. Hello, Chris.
Hi, it's great to be on the show.
Chris, at your University of Toronto presentation, you talked about four kinds of bias that would affect an expert witness: selection, affiliation, compensation, and hindsight. At the 40,000 foot level, could you explain what each of these are?
Sure. Selection bias is the problem that the expert witnesses that are actually brought to trial to the litigation process are handpicked by the litigants and may not actually represent the distribution of opinion of the relevant experts in the field. Affiliation and compensation biases go together in that once you've selected an expert, you sort of bring them onto the team and coach them and pay them as long as they're giving favorable opinions, and in that way further distort the opinion given towards your particular side in the case. And hindsight bias is a much more general psychological problem, that when we look back and try to answer a question with additional knowledge, that knowledge can really prevent us from answering the question at hand more fairly. So evaluating whether a risk was sizable or not can be distorted once that risk has materialized. So that's hindsight bias.
So let's deal with the first, selection bias. A litigation lawyer might get disbarred if he called an expert who didn't agree with his client's case. But in your presentation, you had a bell curve that showed the spectrum of opinions that could be given. And on one end was an opinion that favored, let's say, the plaintiff's side. And at the other end was an opinion that favored the defendant's side. And as I understood it, you were saying what we really end up doing is choosing from each of these ends, which doesn't really represent the center of the bell curve or perhaps where an objective witness might land.
That's right. I mean, in a given case, I think it's useful to think about a distribution of opinions of how they would answer exactly this question if you had, say, 100 qualified experts. And so the hope is that, you know, there really will be scientific consensus or clarity on a question. And that's really not what we get in the trial if you're only talking to, you know, two experts, one from each side. That tends to really overrepresent whichever side would have been in the minority in the true distribution from the field. So that's that selection bias. It's the same problem if I was trying to do a population survey about, you know, who's going to be the next president, and I handpicked particular people that would give an answer I liked. It would be useless. That survey would be useless for reflecting the true behaviors of the population.
All right. So affiliation bias. I have sensed in my practice that there is something of a Stockholm syndrome that occurs with expert witnesses as they tend to drift as the case goes on closer and closer to your side of the case. And it's almost a slow brainwashing exercise that occurs deliberately or not. Is that what we're talking about in terms of an affiliation bias?
That's right. It goes into coaching the expert, making them part of your team. It happens in the day-by-day interactions, the phone calls, the steak dinners, the long nights, you know, preparing for a deposition, all of these efforts, and in some cases, you're, you know, the attorneys actually write the expert report or edit the expert report, again, shaping it towards the litigation position of that side, and really shaping it then away from whatever the raw expertise out in the world, you know, would have delivered in terms of an opinion.
So you said that compensation bias is a subset of affiliation bias. Could you explain that a little further?
Sure. You know, it would be clearly unethical to pay an expert witness a contingent fee based on, you know, the outcome of the case. They're supposed to be delivering an objective expert opinion. But in fact, you know, the hourly rate that we pay most experts is contingent. We don't continue paying an expert after you've consulted them and they give you an opinion that's unfavorable because you don't need that expert for your case in particular. So there's nothing unethical about this. I'm not suggesting we're bribing experts, but as the compensation structure is experienced by the expert, it gives them a real incentive to give opinions that are favorable to their client as a way to ensure that they get more hourly work from that client in the same case or in subsequent cases.
Now, a lot of courts, including our federal court in Canada, require expert witnesses to affirm in a declaration that they've read the code of conduct for expert witnesses and agree to be bound by it, that they have an overriding duty to assist the court impartially, that that duty overrides any duty to a party, and they're not going to be an advocate, and they're going to be independent and objective. What's your opinion of the effectiveness of these types of undertakings?
So a lot of the problems I've identified are really systematic biases, like selection bias, or deep psychological biases that can affect an expert, even when the expert tries their hardest to nonetheless be fair and objective. So the research about these sorts of efforts to try not to be subject to bias have been shown to really be unhelpful because the problems are deeper than that. The problem isn't that isn't typically that we have unethical experts. It's rather that the situation that experts work in systematically biases their opinions. So based on my review of the evidence, I'm not confident that that this practice of signing a document makes much difference at all, and I'm sure not confident it resolves the problem of expert bias.
The fourth category of bias that you discussed is hindsight bias. Could you explain hindsight bias a little further?
Sure. So we've worked with experts in one field, for example, radiology, to study the effects of knowledge that a patient later, say, died of cancer, how that knowledge affects a radiologist who then looks back on the radiological slide to determine whether there was a tumor there, say, 5 years before, and relatedly determine then whether the clinical radiologist missed the tumor negligently or not. And the research overwhelmingly shows that this additional information about the client's later death makes a huge difference in interpreting the slide. It makes it much easier to find a tumor, and upon finding it, say, you know, it was negligent to miss it. And that's regardless of whether you tell someone, oh, don't think about the hindsight, you know, try not to be subject to hindsight bias. It's just a subconscious, implicit bias that affects experts in this domain. Another area this has been tried is with judges, a randomized experiment with judges, telling them, asking them to evaluate whether a precaution should have been taken against a risk, and they randomized judges to either know that the risk materialized or know that the risk didn't materialize, and consistently the ones in the hindsight condition thought that the precaution was much, much more reasonable. But of course, that would systematically bias negligence determinations. If the fact of the injury itself is used in hindsight to suggest greater precaution should have been taken. So I think there are probably very similar problems in intellectual property as well when you're asking, for example, an expert to determine what a reasonable royalty rate might have been, if they actually know that the product was hugely successful or not, or if you're asking them to determine whether an innovation was obvious or not, again, once they know that the innovation was in fact discovered, it can look a lot more obvious in hindsight. Although I don't know that there's been scientific research on that particular sort of question.
One of the mechanisms you've proposed for reducing or eliminating some of these biases is blinding. Could you explain what blinding is?
Sure. So blinding is a technique that's been used in lots of domains to try to eliminate extraneous information from a decision maker on the thought that if they don't know the information, they can't be biased by it. So this is used, for example, in biomedical research. If you're testing a drug, for example, ideally you want to do a double-blind randomized controlled trial, meaning that the patients will be blinded as to whether they're on placebo or the drug, and the physicians and the assessors will also be blinded as to each patient's status, so that no one can sort of bias the results by sheer hope that the product is working. Instead, we want to make sure it's really working biologically. So similarly, we've been working with expert witnesses in some domains to improve the credibility of their testimony and the reliability of their testimony by blinding them where appropriate. So, for example, radiologists can be asked to review a particular slide that is at issue in a case to determine whether a tumor was present. But we put the slide in a mixture with 10 other cases, so they don't really know which one is at issue and can't really focus on it. It puts them more similar to the clinical setting of the original treating physician. And then we also don't tell them which side, plaintiff or defense, in a medical malpractice case is asking for their opinion. And that really then eliminates affiliation bias. And in compensation bias, we'll pay them for their opinion either way. And then finally, for hindsight bias, we don't tell the expert when rendering that opinion that the patient did in fact have a bad outcome and is now suing, because that would create hindsight bias. So in those situations, we're working on really improving the reliability of the expert testimony by carefully constructing the space in which they make a decision.
When you ask an expert to find something, are you creating a bias towards trying to find something?
This is one reason, though, we give them an entire slew of cases, you know, with and without tumors, to review all at the same time. And so we ask them to decide every single case. They're essentially dummies. And that really reduces their effort on the particular case to find a problem. And that's more similar to how they actually read cases in the clinical setting. But I'll say I'm also working with a team of teleradiologists to work on actually putting litigation cases back in the clinical workflow, so those other cases aren't just dummies. They are actual cases they're reading day in and day out. And in that way, if the blinding succeeds, you can really completely eliminate that focal bias, because it's just another clinical case they're reading again.
One of the solutions, Chris, you've recommended for avoiding some of these types of biases is to use an intermediary between the client and the lawyer on the one hand and the expert on the other hand. Could you explain that further?
Sure. And that's really essential for the selection, affiliation, and compensation biases, because, you know, if an attorney just calls up an expert, it will either be obvious or very easy to figure out which side that attorney is representing. And then once that happens, you've really created the foundation for all these biases. So the solution is to create an intermediary, a blinding protocol, who would work with attorneys to find experts in an unbiased way, perhaps randomly selecting from a list of qualified ones, and then contact the experts and recruit them to work on the case, giving them a flat fee to render an opinion, you know, regardless of how it turns out, and giving them the materials they need to do so, whether it's, you know, the medical records or the prior art, depending on the case, and also, you know, working to make sure the questions posed by the attorney are both sufficient, they will actually answer the legal questions needed, but also that they don't tip the hand, you know, if the questions are framed in such an obvious way that it's that which side is asking, then that would undermine the blind too. So it requires an intermediary to have some pretty sophisticated skills in working both with the lawyers and the expert, again, to protect the expert from any biasing influences when they render their opinion.
What you seem to be describing sounds to me like a clean room that is used in either semiconductor chip fabrication or in making software, where everyone is isolated from outside influences. And in this particular case, the intermediary is acting as that clean room.
That's right. And you know, another analogy you could use is in the U.S. system, we have these elaborate rules of evidence to protect a jury from getting extraneous, you know, prejudicial information. And in that sense, the judge becomes sort of an intermediary to make sure to sort of filter out biasing evidence that shouldn't go to the jury at all. So we actually use blinding in the legal system in the U.S. side quite routinely.
Well, I understand how a blinded expert can be more credible, but I understand that your research has shown that there's a real financial benefit to using a blinded expert. Could you explain what your research has shown?
That's right. We've studied the use of blinded experts in among juries, and so we created a very robust randomized experiment with several hundred jurors and randomized them to decide a case with a very realistic video of a trial with jury instructions and openings and direct arguments and cross-examinations for both sides, closing arguments and jury instructions. It was an entire miniature trial. But we randomly manipulated whether the plaintiff's expert was blinded versus a hired gun or the defense expert is blinded versus a hired gun or neither one. But we had to do it, you know, in a realistic way through the expert's own direct testimony. So you'd ask a question like, well, how were you retained? And, you know, the answer is, well, I was called by this intermediary. And did you know who was asking? No. It sort of played out how the blinding really worked. And in fact, then where they were cross-examined a little bit by the other side to poke at the blinding, and similarly, the unblinded expert was cross-examined a little bit to show that they were potentially subject to bias. And what we found then is we asked the jurors to decide the case. We didn't tell them what we were interested in the blinding thing at all. You know, it was a, but we just said, now decide the case. And we found that the side with the blinded expert was much more likely to win. It affected their chance of winning very substantially. And when they did win, it shifted the damages favorably. So if plaintiffs had a blind expert, they awarded about $100,000 more to that side. Or if the defense had a blind expert, they more often got a zero verdict. And when they did lose, it was a smaller loss. So exactly what you'd want, using a blinded expert for one side or the other. So our thought is that this then creates an incentive for litigants to use blinding. This is a different way to communicate that you have a credible, reliable expert and thereby, you know, win more for your client.
So does this mean that juries are biased in favor of blinded experts?
Well, I sure wouldn't put it that way. I think the idea of bias means, you know, really a departure from a normal, appropriate way of considering the facts. And so here, the fact of blinding is we'd call it a heuristic. It's a judgment cue, not unlike the fact that the expert has great credentials or they've published in the relevant field or, they were more internally coherent than the other expert. All these are cues for the laypersons to evaluate the testimony. And we think that lack of bias evinced by blinding is a similar cue to evaluate the testimony.
So your research has shown that a more objective witness is also a more persuasive witness.
That's right. Just on the margin, it helped. We measured this a bunch of different ways. We asked, you know, specific questions about which do you think is more expert, which one is more believable, you know, da-da-da. So in addition to win rate, it appears that they just are more persuasive as a witness. You know, I'll just mention this is quite, what really has inspired me to do this work is in my own litigation, I had a case as a lawyer where we had an expert, or we had a witness who was actually the treating physician of the plaintiff, and he'd rendered an opinion in the course of treatment that was really helpful to the plaintiff's litigation case, as it turned out. But the doctor who rendered this opinion for treatment purpose had no idea about the litigation at all when they did it. And so that doctor ended up being a very persuasive witness to the jury compared to the other side's hand-picked experts that were paid millions of dollars and flown in from all over the country. It was that sort of cue that, oh, I can believe this guy. He's just calling the medicine as he sees it. And so the goal of blinding is to try to replicate that same objectivity when you don't happen to have the lucky opinion that was rendered outside litigation.
Thanks very much for these insights, Chris.
My pleasure. Happy to be here.
Dr. Chris Robertson is a professor of law at the University of Arizona and is currently teaching law at NYU Law and on sabbatical. For further information on Dr. Robertson's presentation at the University of Toronto on bias in litigation science, as well as his 2010 paper on blind expertise, and further information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.